Go get him!
Taylor! Why did you run away?
Security police.
I'm in charge of this man.
No longer, madam. He is now in the custody of the Ministry of Science.
Take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape!
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake and the final week of Prime April Apocalypse. Yeah, I've renamed it. It's now Prime April Apocalypse because of all the theoretical complaining about the monkey last week, even though I haven't actually heard any complaints yet. Because it technically hasn't come out yet as people have heard this or hearing this as of this recording. But I'm sure it'll come. Last week we did Monkey Shines, and this week we wrap it up with the most obvious one, the one I'm sure everybody wanted us to do, and we are going to deliver on Planet of the Apes from 1968 and the 2001 Tim Burton remake. Oh boy, we're going to have some fun here, and with us today, as always, is Trish Coughlin.
Hey everybody.
And Sam Stepanenko.
My spaceship is still flying.
And... Well, that's good. We don't have to give you a pill for that then.
No, and I haven't crash landed on a strange planet in the future with apes that have evolved to the dominant species
that you know of.
That I know of. It could be changing as we speak.
It could be changing.
In theory, human beings are kind of descended from apes. In theory, we are kind of living in a world where apes have evolved to become the dominant species.
And our own resident monkey, Jeff Omega.
Oh, hello.
Hello. This is going to wrap up Prime April Apocalypse, and if you guys liked it, make sure you let us know, and we might bring it back, because there are more apes and monkey movies we can do, for sure. Mm-hmm. And we'll be happy to do so, because this was a fun month for us, I think. And we had a nice mix. We had some horror, we had some comedy, and science fiction.
Just straight up action.
It's good. It was a good month.
Cap it all off with a generic summer blockbuster. We have everything.
Certainly was.
Because there's certainly no science in this fiction.
I do feel this was where part of Tim Burton's soul was crushed.
Yes.
Yeah.
But
you know, not to just jump the gun, but as I was saying to Amelia, and when we were watching it yesterday, I was just struck so much by... Like, it's very shocking how that movie has so much going for it, and, like, it just doesn't mesh, it doesn't meld, it doesn't work, but there's a lot going for it.
It looks fabulous, and there's some great performances, like that Rick Baker makeup is so good. So good.
Yes.
Yeah, Paul Giamatti is so good in that movie, too.
Yeah, Paul Giamatti, Tim Roth. I mean, there's so many great actors and performances in there. I think if it hadn't have been a remake and stood by itself, it would have probably done a lot better than it did. I think there's part of it is the comparisons to that original film, which is just so strong in terms of storytelling and character development.
The weird thing that I had no idea about until yesterday is this Planet of the Apes movie did make money. Like, it had a 2.65 multiplier. Like, it more than doubled its money.
The remake had a budget of $100 million. It's a big budget movie. I mean, it is a Tim Burton, and he was very bankable at the time. Had an opening weekend domestically of $68.5 million, which is nothing to sneeze at, and grossed $180 million and change domestically, which is not a great hit, but worldwide, $362 million. So that's pretty good. But when you consider... a budget of $100 million. And the massive marketing that went into that movie, yeah, I can see why there wasn't a sequel, because that it wasn't super profitable. I mean, that's still nothing to sneeze at. They probably made some money, but probably not as much to justify the budget on that movie. I mean, you could make the same movie now and it'd probably do much better because the global audience has gotten much bigger.
Yeah. And part of this, people really love built-in brand recognition now.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And part of it is Tim Burton said that they couldn't pay him enough to do a sequel.
No.
After working on this film. The studio set the release date before he even started filming.
Yes.
And they would not move it. And that's part of what I think why this movie feels a little disjointed, is because he was pigeonholed.
It does feel very much like a typical studio movie and less like a Tim Burton project.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, aside from some of the visuals, like the look and of the armor and stuff like that, it doesn't really feel very Tim Burton-ish.
Like, the most Tim Burton aspect of the movie really is the extra effort that was put into the world building and design of like the costuming and everything. I could see it being made by the people who Tim Burton works with, but if I didn't know that Tim Burton directed it, I would have never guessed.
The clear message that this is a Tim Burton movie is Helena Bonham Carter, right?
Yeah.
The movie where they met.
Yeah. And Lisa Marie, who also worked with them often.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, this was the handoff between Lisa Marie and Helena Bonham Carter.
Yeah. Yep, tag, you're it.
Yep.
Yeah, I was saying it is kind of funny that Tim Burton met and presumably fell in love with Helena Bonham Carter while they're making a movie where she looks like an ape the whole time.
Yeah.
You know, and even though it's not a great movie, she's fairly attractive as an ape.
she is, and it's sort of like they keep enough ape-like qualities, but you're still very enamored of like how they all look as apes.
Yeah, there is a certain recognizable quality to everybody. Like, you can kind of see the actors underneath. It's
Paul
not,
Giamatti especially.
Yeah, his was very expressive. I really liked how his looked, but he still probably looked probably the most ape-like out of anybody. But you could still see some of the actor underneath all that. Unlike the original movie, even though the makeup was pretty good at the time, it didn't allow for a ton of expression, and you certainly didn't get to see the actor underneath it so much. You're just trying to go mostly by voice recognition.
Yeah.
More than anything else.
I was reading that like Roddy McDowall was kind of giving pointers to all of the ape actors, basically telling everybody to over-exaggerate their facial tics and like basically be more pantomimey, just so the masks wouldn't look like masks. You know, like extra blinking, extra over-moving your mouth whenever you're talking, just to give it more personality. Yeah, definitely. I feel like Roddy McDowall was more comfortable in the makeup than some other people in that original movie.
Well, he was probably one of the few veterans in that cast, along with Charlton Heston, of course. Definitely the most experienced actors on that set at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a brutal shoot for Charlton Heston, from my understanding, for the original Planet of the Apes from 1968. He was sick for most of that shoot. They're shooting in the desert from May till August.
Ooh, man.
Subsequent sequels shot in that desert would be usually in the fall or winter seasons. For obvious reasons, because at some point everybody in cast and crew probably passed out from what reading from heat.
I mean, can you imagine how hot those costumes are? My God.
Charlton Heston at least would have been not too bad being in loincloth most of the time, but I mean, being sick and then being pelted by the water hose while he was in the cage, that must have been brutal.
Yeah, there's a commitment there. I mean, as much as you may not agree with Heston's politics, you do have to respect his commitment as an actor.
Yeah, no, he was always committed to his roles. And when you figure what he went through on that one, it's no wonder his role in the second one was so small and then he was out. I'm out of here.
Yeah. I don't want to do this no more.
Well, he was in the remake, he's lying in a bed. I mean, come on, that's an easy role.
Well, at that point, he was this was just a few more years before he passed, so the remake. Yeah. So, I mean, the fact that he went full ape makeup to do his cameo, that's a testament even then at that age, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
I don't know if you guys...
David, oh God, what's his name? Who played Ari's dad. God, very famous actor. Damn it, I'll think of it. But yeah, he went in full makeup, and he was pretty elderly at that time, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're talking about, David Warner, you're talking about.
That's it, David Warner,
yeah.
He was about as old as Heston and moving around in the makeup.
No, he's about as old as Heston today as when Heston died. No, he would have been probably in his mid-60s.
Still then. Old.
Yeah, no, he was old, but he wasn't Heston old.
Yeah. Well, Heston looked old in the original, so.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Heston probably had 20 years on David Warner, I would think.
Tim Roth actually didn't want to do the scene with Heston.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he didn't.
Because he disagreed with his politics. He actually said, if I had known that I was going to have to do a scene with Heston, I would have turned down the role.
Wow.
Oh.
But yeah, he's a professional, and he did it, and he said he kept the politics out of it because he was getting paid to do his job.
That's what professionals wind up doing, but that could be another reason. Like, I don't know how that set was, but it's starting to sound like it wasn't the best set either.
Well, talking about politics, what was really interesting is in the original, there's a bunch of it written by Rod Serling. And I know at the beginning where Heston's sitting there just musing by the control panel, being like, well, is man still killing other men and like starving his next door neighbor? Mm-hmm. And I'm sitting there going like, okay, so he delivered the lines like he cared and then went on in his personal life to do the exact opposite. So, I mean, he was being professional.
And that's one thing I really do love about the original one is, just to bring up Rod Serling and my ears perk up, but yeah, like you can tell it's written by Rod Serling. It has a lot of his like angry social commentary in it.
Yeah, there's a lot still in there. Like his script was rewritten, but he was the primary script writer on it. He spent like a good year just reworking and reworking that script over and over and over again. Like I can't even remember how many drafts he wrote. It was somewhere in like the 30s, 30 wow. drafts of that thing before it finally went to a different screenwriter. And that was when the director, Franklin Schaffner, came on board, who pulled it back a little bit. The original book by Pierre Boulle had a more futuristic society. They peeled it back to more of that kind of primal setting, even though they had guns and stuff. Uh-huh. Little bit of post-apocalyptic thing going on there, where there's some remnants of technology, but it's still a more basic society. Mainly did that because of budget constraints. I mean, the budget of the movie for 1968 was $5.8 million. And at least $500,000 was in the makeup effects.
Well, unquestionably, and yeah. I would have expected it to be a little bit more.
Oh, they like to, and you might even hear it in the ad we'll run shortly. They did overtell it to the media as about $1 million of the budget was makeup, and it did win a special Academy Award for its makeup effects when an award for makeup didn't even exist yet. The first award didn't actually happen until 1981, I want to say. Which, yeah, they, ironically, right. was Rick Baker for, I do believe, American Werewolf in London.
Mm. Yeah, I do know the guy, Jack something, my goodness, who did the special effects in the original one. He was only the second ever makeup artist to win an Oscar. And, huge deal when they basically roll out and say, this isn't a category, but we're giving you an award anyway.
Because it's that impressive, yeah. And, you watch that movie, and in my memory, I don't remember it being as expressive as it was. By today's techniques and stuff, it's a fucking rock on our face. But you can, when you watch the movie, I'm like, wow, you can actually see, like, the smile of Roddy McDowall or Kim Hunter. Like, you can actually see some expression in that makeup more than I actually remembered from my youth. And maybe that was because I remember the TV show where they barely moved at all.
Yeah. I definitely think that the later the movies kind of went on, the more the masks became, like, literal actual masks instead of a multi-piece appliance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that was to reduce budget and reduce makeup time.
Yeah.
And from what I was reading, a lot of the cast would just stay in makeup when they were eating and stuff. So a lot of their meals were liquefied and that sort of thing, which being in the desert was probably a good thing. But, drinking through straws and using cigarette holders to smoke and that sort of thing, because applying it takes so long, right? A lot of the cast wound up doing similar things on the Tim Burton one as well, I would imagine, because that's some pretty intricate makeup.
Yeah, and actually, you keep mentioning the desert, and that's something that I wanted just to bring up, because that's one thing I really, really enjoy about the remake more, is the fact that their city is integrated into the jungle, which would be more ape-like, versus them out in the middle of a desert, which is, I mean, apes aren't in the desert. They are in under canopy and in trees and stuff like that. So that felt more organic to me. And that's one thing I really loved about Burton's version is the way he did that. And I mean, as you said, it was about budget, but it's one of the few things in that remake that worked better for me.
Mind you, I know it is kind of partly about budget, but I believe actually part of the whole idea of having it desert is I liked it because it kind of pushed into the whole ending where the world has been destroyed. So there is going to be a lot of desert.
Yeah, they do play into it a bit later as well, where like the forbidden zone is New York City. Like, it's a desert because it was wiped out from fallout. But you can still have, like, they worked around the nuclear fallout thing in the Tim Burton one. Like, that wasn't an aspect at all.
Oh, no, because it was a different planet.
Mm-hmm.
Which is truer to the book.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was like a planet located near Betelgeuse in the Belt of Orion, wasn't it?
Something like that. I don't know. I've never actually read the book. I just know that Burton's version is actually closer to what was originally written in the novel, both in terms of setting and the ending.
Both of them do have that kind of Rod Serling, like, let's give a twist, although you do kind of expect it from the Burton one, and it's a little more eye-rolling with the Burton one.
You know what? Honestly, I think that the ending, like, for everything that could be said about the 2001 movie, the ending is, like, so crazy, but it's also so interesting. I was saying yesterday while we were watching it that it's like that whole movie is just a setup for a more interesting, better sequel.
Part of what bothers me about that ending, the ending of the Burton's already undermined because an original exists, so you're already expecting a twist. So that doesn't help. But when you see General Thade statue instead of the Lincoln Memorial, you realize everything you just watched doesn't fucking matter.
it doesn't
accomplish nothing.
I mean, in fact, like, he did make things actively worse.
Yeah. Although you do wonder how Thade was memorialized. It was, well, as soon as he got released from his cage, I guess he just went back to doing what he was doing and slaughtered all the humans.
and like, it begs the question, like, how far back did, like, presumably he's on Earth and he went back in time or something. Is this 1800s Thade on Earth during the Civil War? Is this, like, it's pretty wild. Like, to replace Abraham Lincoln, just all the questions that arises are interesting, but maybe not. Yeah, I think it's frustrating that the most interesting part of the movie is, like, a tacked-on ending.
Well, I was
in terms of a story, anyway. But
I was reading something about this, and this is sort of the quote-unquote semi-explanation for it, where in the quote-unquote electromagnet/time storm, Pericles goes through first, arrives last. Leo goes in second, arrives second. And the Oberon goes in last, arrives first. So if Leo goes back first, and then, like, Thade somehow gets out and comes back, he'll arrive, like, before him somehow. Hmm. Like, that was the weird explanation that was given, and that how the timeline of how everybody arrived to Planet of the Apes is going to mirror when they all arrive at Earth, which is, like, the last person will arrive first, and it just gets really weird from there.
Hmm. It's still pretty weak, and it doesn't explain how Thade got there.
They would at least try to explain it. I would have been on board, but they didn't.
How did they get there, too? I mean, because the ship was obviously not functioning, especially after what he did to it. And then Leo's ship was, I mean, I suppose salvageable. It was under the water there. But how does he arrange for that if all the apes are now against him?
I know. Yeah. And, like, Pericles' ship was the only one intact.
Yes. So there's a big hole in the story there that's never explained.
I assume the sequel was supposed to explain it.
Quite likely, yes. And the other big hole in it, and it, I mean, maybe I missed something while I was watching it, but there's a lot of humans. So that or obviously evolved from the original crew of the ship, but the apes killed them all. So where did the humans come from?
That was my question too.
You know, and it just not from a storytelling standpoint, but another thing that does bug me a lot, probably the most out of the remake, is so you have all of these apes living in the society who are treating humans like second-class citizens or like slaves and like they're not human or whatever, right? And in the original one, you kind of can buy it because none of the humans can speak. Like, they all act like animals. But I feel like it's a lot harder. It's a lot harder of a pill to swallow when you're like, nobody thinks that these creatures have souls and are intelligent. But they can talk. They can communicate. They have every sign of being, like, similar to the apes. But just make the humans talk in the second one is what I'm trying to say. Really undermined the message that was there.
Can I bring up the human slave trade of black people?
Well, yeah, but yes. But even so,
they
yeah.
can talk. They could reason. They had souls, but they weren't thought of as such.
No, Ian, you're absolutely right. But I think that the like, while that's true, I feel like, and if you're trying to give a message in a movie, you shouldn't give a message with also an expectation of a historical explanation when it is just easier to use the shorthand of the humans don't talk, especially considering the humans don't have anything interesting to do or say in the remake.
Yeah.
Like if at the very least they did anything or could use their speech for something that impacted anything.
Well, let's take a break. We will check out the original trailer for the 1968 Planet of the Apes, and we'll get into some discussion about how much the Tim Burton one might be a modern SJW version of Planet of the Apes. But we'll have some arguments about that, and we will be right back after this awesome trailer for Planet of the Apes.
Can't help thinking that somewhere in the universe there has to be something better than man. Has to be.
The words are Charlton Heston's.
Get out a last signal to Earth, and we've landed!
The world he finds out in the galaxy will challenge every idea you've ever had of civilization. A planet where man is the lowest order of living things, and the superior beings are apes. They build the cities, make the laws, the gods, and control the guns that hunt a race of lowly, terrified humans who run wild in the jungles, are caged in the prisons, and stuffed in the museums. 20th Century Fox transforms the motion picture screen into Planet of the Apes. Pierre Boulle's finest novel since Bridge on the River Kwai.
The world gone insane. An upside-down civilization that could not be real. Yes, a world of madness and terror.
Man has no understanding. He can be taught a few simple tricks, nothing more.
You did it. You cut up his brain, you funny baboon! Not end here. It ended in an episode so unpredictable, so shocking, that it made the horror which preceded it seem calm and gentle as a summer's night. A great many people worked long and hard to answer the question of what a civilization would be like where the evolutionary process had been reversed and apes were the superior species. Hundreds of technicians and the largest number of makeup artists ever assembled assisted the producers, the writers, the director, and the cast, Dr. Cornelius, Roddy McDowell, Dr. Zira is played by Kim Hunter, Dr. Zayas is portrayed by Maurice Evans, and Nova by Linda Harrison.
Now the tribunal has placed you in my custody for final disposition. You realize what that means?
No.
Emasculation to begin with. Then experimental surgery on the speech centers, on the brain. Eventually a kind of living death.
Planet of the Apes, beyond your wildest dreams.
And we're back.
Woo.
Yeah. Love those classic trailers. You
know, I was reading that all of the, like, the drum percussional instruments and everything, like the first atonal movie score.
It was.
Jerry Goldsmith wore a gorilla mask while composing it.
That's very method for your music.
Yeah.
It's interesting you bring up the soundtrack of this because when I was watching the movie, I was actually astounded at how little of a soundtrack there actually was. There's a lot of moments in the movie that are quiet, like as far as music, and they're just letting the actors be, especially that final moment with the damn you blew it up, all that stuff with the Statue of Liberty. It's stark. There's no music. It's just the rolling of the ocean.
And that's what makes it work. I think that makes it more powerful.
Yeah. It lets you sit on the moment and feel that impact of that realization that he was never on another planet. He was on his own. He had made it home. just thousands of years too late.
And especially the first time watching it, it's like, oh, wow, that is, and it really rocks you.
Mm-hmm.
The first time you see it. I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen the original. Certainly more than once, obviously. Mm-hmm. More than twice, even. I remember being probably about 10 or 11 and sort of, they were all on TV fairly regularly. So I loved them and watched them. I haven't watched them in a long time, mind you, just because there's so much out there to watch. Sometimes it just, you don't think to go back to these classic films. And I still love the first one. It's, as an adult, I'm not finding it as good as I remembered it, but it's still the superior film by far.
Yeah, it is really good. It was my first time watching, well, I was mentioning before we started recording, but when I watched the first one a couple days ago, we ended up just rolling it into watching all five original Planet of the Apes movies. Nice. It had been the first time for me since I was probably 16. And yeah, they held up. They were all better than I remembered, other than the first one, which I've seen a lot of times. It did take me by surprise at how good all of them were.
I was going to do that as well, but then I was worried I'd get confused about what happened in which movie, which can, sometimes they can bleed together.
I wanted to do it, but I figured, yeah, much like that year, I would probably get them confused. So I will probably continue afterwards.
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to do that later today.
And I love the prequel ones that they're doing now, and I'm sure we'll talk about them somewhat, because they had all their homages, and they tried to sneak them into the Tim Burton one as well. You know, they twist them on its head, you know, get your paws off me, you damn dirty ape. The lines kind of turned around. So it's Michael Duncan Clark's Atar who gets to say it instead to the humans. Let's get into the cast of the original Planet of the Apes here for 1968, based on the novel by Pierre Boulle, who also wrote Bridge on the River Kwai, which was also another fantastic film. Screenplay was by Michael Wilson, who wrote Bridge on the River Kwai. Rod Serling also worked on this script, most famous for The Night Gallery and Twilight Zone. And additional dialogue was by John T. Kelly, who is uncredited and wrote for several TV shows like Dr. Kilgare and the Alfred Hitchcock Presents television series. Yeah, so let's get into this. Directed by Franklin Schaffner, who directed Patton and Papillon. Charlton Heston, of course, stars as George Taylor, best known for Ben-Hur, The Ten Commandments. And we talked about him in our very, very first episode.
Omega Man.
That's right, the Omega Man. Roddy McDowall is Cornelius in this movie, and we have talked about him a whole bunch that I actually had to write off the page. He may be the actor who we've talked about the most on this show.
I have five, six including this one.
Six including this one, yeah.
I was thinking the other day, like, Roddy McDowall, he's one of those actors where, like, you know, he died a while ago now, and he's kind of not present in the kind of pop culture consciousness, and he needs to be talked about more. He was a phenomenal actor.
Well, we've talked about him a lot, and the first time we talked about him was in episode 45.
That was Fright Night.
Correct. Then episode 102.
Class of 84.
That's right. I skipped ahead because in episode 69, we talked about Poseidon. That was right. Poseidon Adventure. Then in episode 151.
Bedknobs and Broomsticks.
And then
fun.
That was a very fun episode. And most recently in episode 216.
That would be The Black Hole. He was in a lot of stuff that we've done.
Yes.
He's the original that guy in that thing.
He really is.
He might be, yeah. I remember him doing some voices on Pinky and the Brain as well.
Yeah.
No, he's one of those guys who just, like, he just wanted to work. He's like, oh, yeah, I'll do that.
Also starring the beautiful Kim Hunter as Zira, but we can't tell she's beautiful because she's under a whole lot of makeup on this one, but she's a very accomplished actress who was best known for Streetcar Named Desire. She was Stella in that movie.
And she's still working. She had a movie out last year.
Yeah, no, she's still going. Maurice Evans was Dr. Zaius, and he was in Rosemary's Baby, The Jerk, and it was in a ton of stuff. He had a great career as well. And if you watch the first prequel movie, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, there is a gorilla introduced in there named Maurice, which I'm pretty sure was named after Maurice Evans. I can't corroborate on that. I haven't read any facts, but come on. That seems kind of obvious, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty in your face.
Yeah.
I mean, Dr. Zaius especially is like one of the most memorable apes out of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
he's the one everybody remembers, and I mean, he's quote unquote the bad guy. You're right. And there's something I want to talk about that, but I'll save that.
I'll wait till your end of casting, but I have something to add as well.
The Dr. Zaius thing. I keep thinking of the Amadeus song. And the Simpsons episode where they do the Planet of the Apes stage production.
You can talk, he can talk,
that
he can talk.
That was running through my head the entire time.
Me too.
Very distracting.
Help me, Dr. Zaius.
I'm going to have to go look that up, because I've never seen it, because I'm not a Simpsons watcher.
It's
so
fabulous.
It's really funny.
It works so well.
James Whitmore was the president of the assembly, and he was in the Shawshank Redemption, so... He was in some good stuff even long after this movie. James Daly was Honorius, and he was in The Big Bounce. Linda Harrison was Nova. She had a nice long career as well, and you always wondered, of like, hey, can she act? Because she never had any dialogue in this movie. She just looked hot. But she would go on to things like Cocoon and stuff in her senior years, so she was fabulous. Robert Gunner was Landon, and he was in Our Man Flint. And Lou Wagner was Lucius. He was in Airport. Woodrow Parfait was Maximus. He might be best known for being in Dirty Harry, but we talked about him in episode 12.
One of the ones that brings up a lot of actors, Used Cars. It's like every couple of weeks, Used Cars comes back up.
It does.
Used Cars is so underrated.
And it has such a huge cast. I think that's part of it, right?
Yeah, I think the Jeffs like it more than I did, but you can go back to episode 12 and get my opinion there. Jeff Burton was Dodge, and he was in a different Flint movie, In Like Flint. And Buck Cantalion was Julius. And I wrote down a few things he was in because I thought these were great titles. The Acid Eaters.
That's a great title.
Octoman.
Also a great title.
That's a sci-fi original.
Oh, this one's probably my favorite. This is probably my favorite. Please Don't Eat Mother.
Oh, my.
I can't wait to see some of these movies.
I'm working on my Shudder original script right now.
Those are some great titles. So that's all I wrote down for the cast, but it had a pretty cool cast. Lots of great actors under some makeup. It's funny how like the speaking roles with the humans, and most of the humans were killed off right away as far as the ones that could speak other than Charlton Heston and get him out of the way. But
yeah.
I had a problem. Like, I really like this movie, but every time I watch it, I keep forgetting how much of an asshole Taylor was.
Oh, he is.
He's a complete asshole.
He is totally out of Austin.
Yeah, and it's kind of weird. Like, he's picking on Landon when they land, as if they've never been on a crew together. And you would figure astronauts would be training together. So he's just learning about Landon now and just making assumptions about him. Even though he seems to know the female astronaut a lot closer with Stewart, even though she's dead right away. I think we get one scene of her laying there and then her desiccated corpse when they all wake up. This was the other problem I had. He basically says she was Eve. So what, three guys, we're just going to go down on her to create a new society?
Well, that was dumb part. You can't do that. Like, no. They cover this in, like, there's a TV show called, no, but there's a thing in You, Me, and the Apocalypse. There's a whole series like about the apocalypse coming. And what happens is at the end, this president thinks, oh, I got all these Eves. I'm going to bang all these women. And they end up killing him. It's like going, no, if you're going to repopulate, you just need women and a bunch of vials of sperm. You technically don't need any men. So this was a dumb idea in the beginning.
Well, and let's not forget about the degradation of the genes. I'm like, yes, you have three men knocking out one woman, but
yeah, that was my first thought.
The children, when they start relating, they're still 50% hers.
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, so your plan was to inbreed an entire society. You're going to wind up being all these mute people on this planet, and they're going to be above you on the evolutionary ladder.
My other problem with it seemed to be that, I don't know, like the one other that wasn't Langdon and wasn't Taylor, the other astronaut,
Dodge.
Like Dodge seemed to have like a background in like biology, but the other two didn't seem to, I didn't know what they were doing. Like a biologist makes sense on a sort of space journey like this. Like you'd have a biologist, you'd have like somebody who specializes in animals. Like Taylor's specialty didn't seem apparent to me. Like, I didn't know.
I got the feeling Taylor was the pilot. I didn't know what really Langdon did. But Taylor, I figured his specialty was being a pilot.
Yeah, I mean, he seemed like the captain of their crew.
Yeah,
he was
yeah,
the last to go into hyperspace.
But you need more than, I'm sorry, but if you're doing that long of an excursion, you need more than just pilot. The pilot should be able to do more than that.
Well, he was the alpha male. He was all about sort of being the hunter gatherer. Like, I mean, he even sort of established that as on their trek, that he's sort of the one who knows how to survive in a hostile environment, kind of thing. So I think that's sort of they all sort of had roles to play. But going back to those lone female, I mean, there's a lot of ick there. Because
yes,
I mean, she's
a lot of pick.
She's basically a broodmare.
Ah, I know, it's disgusting.
I mean, even then, it should have been disgusting. But it kind of just sort of gets glossed over, probably because it's not really relevant to the story.
It all is just a plot device, just to get Taylor onto the planet of the apes. Probably not much thought was put into that whole aspect of the movie.
I know, it would have been better if they had. But yeah, that's just me.
I would suspect that Serling's original script probably either didn't have that in it, or it made more sense.
It definitely feels like a lost in translation, multiple drafts kind of carryover.
Yeah, I think so. You guys notice, like, they took their time introducing the apes. It was like a good half hour into the film before you actually see them, before the hunt starts, which is the opening of the remake. You're straight into the hunt.
Although the hunt felt more intense in the original one than in the remake, strangely. Like, it
no,
felt
not
a lot
really.
More
it,
like...
It felt like people herding animals in the original, and that it worked so well. It didn't, because they corralled them, right? They used the nets, and they came in from all sides to make sure that nobody escaped, right? And that's what made it so intense, was the fact that you knew there was no escape. You didn't get that from the remake, because it felt a lot more sort of haphazard and random. So it didn't give you that same sense of tension, knowing that there's no way that anybody's going to escape.
Yeah, there's a conspiracy factor to the original that I kind of appreciate as well, because Dr. Zaius seems to be very familiar with the fact that there might have been a different society, and he's very resistant to this coming out, because it would disrupt the society they have and all their beliefs that they currently have. I think Burton addresses it a little bit, but it's a lot more clumsily handled in the script.
The original kind of takes on that whole idea, which is basically what humans had did, where they used kind of like religion and beliefs to like keep in place all these power structures. And if anything came to threaten the power structures, you had to get rid of it because, oh my God, we can't have people thinking stuff.
And yeah, I mean, it, very explosive. Like if just thinking in, if it's an analogy, somebody hiding information about the origin of our species that directly contradicts all known religions and politics is like, it's very explosive as a concept on this planet. And even on Earth, like the idea
on any planet,
on any planet. Yeah. It's a really interesting angle.
Yeah. No,
and I love the reveal with the talking doll. That's like one of my favorite. People talk about the Statue of Liberty, but when they're like, they find the doll and then the doll talks, and like, that's just such a great moment of the movie.
Well, yeah, it's because Zaius is always demanding proof, proof, proof. When they were fairly trigger happy with Landon and just lobotomized him. You had Heston's character was constantly trying to escape and whatnot, and kind of dodging these inevitable either death or lobotomy or whatever. But it was one of those things where, all right, you can't deny this. Why would they make a doll that talks?
Yeah, and that's your first clue that they're actually on Earth.
Yeah, he hasn't clued in that this isn't Earth yet, but you would think that that would be somewhat like, hey, we had dolls like this on our Earth or whatever, that maybe things are starting to click in for him.
No, but, I only just read this right before we started recording, and I'd never heard this before, but apparently there was multiple endings written for the movie, and the one that they went with was the one that Charlton Heston chose.
That's correct. That's what I read as well.
I don't know about the other endings, though.
No, I wish they'd exist. So much of our cinematic history is kind of lost. And we're still seeing that with even more of like old VHS movies that have never gone to DVD and the less likely to hit Blu-ray, and our cinematic history is just kind of going away in some regards, at least the lesser known stuff. And that's a shame. So I'm kind of hoping that somebody will rediscover this stuff and we'll get like an ultimate Planet of the Apes and we get to see some of these other endings. If they were even shot, who knows? They might not have even been shot, but, you know, release the script draft then. That'd be cool to see. Yeah.
Yeah, in general, actually, as a small aside, I would love if people started, you know, making more readily available script drafts.
There are some great script resource sites online. Go check them out. Joe Blow's Scriptorama comes to mind. And I found an unmade Friday the 13th script on there that was fabulous. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so go find them. They are out there. The resources are out there. Maybe I'll try to throw a link up on our social media at some point and give people some stuff to read over their self-isolations.
Yeah, when you should be listening to us.
Yes, after you've listened to us, of course.
Now, I guess talking about script revisions and stuff, what ended up being my rabbit hole for this episode was reading about everything that happened with Planet of the Apes in between the last original, like, canon movie and the Tim Burton one. And it was almost remade 2 or 3 times. But the most crazy one, which I was kind of alluding to before we started recording, was Oliver Stone's version of Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
Which, it's very crazy. Basically, the story boils down to one of his producing partners who made all of the movies with him was a huge Planet of the Apes fan and thought Oliver Stone's the perfect guy to make the movie. So he got a meeting together with a bunch of studio execs. They asked Oliver Stone, and he said, I just watched him a couple days ago, wasn't a big fan. My producing partner, you know, he's more into it. So his producing partner flounders, meeting's going really terribly. And then Oliver Stone just steps in and is like, you know, what if all of time was a circle and there was these, like, cryogenically frozen Vedic apes that had the secret numerical codes to the Bible that predicted the end of all of mankind. And they were like, great. And they paid him $1.5 million. And the script itself is like, it would have starred Arnold Schwarzenegger. And he was really into the script. And he's basically a scientist who discovers how to travel back in time through genetic memory, because the apes invented a deadly disease that is going to wipe out all of humanity. The disease is like babies while in the womb just age to the point of they're like stillborn elderly men, like baby Benjamin Button or whatever. Because all of the babies are dying because they're too old in the womb, a guy figures out how to go back in time to Paleolithic man era and how there's an advanced society of apes like in the Stone Age who are maybe also from the future and maybe time is a circle. And yeah, there's just lots of crazy batshit nonsense. I honestly encourage anybody who's interested to read more about it, because I'm just scratching the surface.
This sounds just as insane as his Conan stuff.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like, I'm obsessed a little bit.
And there's like some versions, tons of people attached to this project at any given time. Like this was going through, it was in development and then dropped and then development and then dropped and then development. Like this sucker was, people kept trying to do it for a very long time, which is kind of why I think that they had basically said, we're releasing it on this date in order to make it actually happen.
Yeah, commit. It's like, yeah, we have an end date now, so we have to make it.
And then they had to like rewrite the script to like bring the budget down. And there was like a whole bunch of other stuff, because there's actually supposed to be an ending where he lands in a baseball stadium and it's apes playing baseball. And that's how he finds out.
I didn't know about that one. Yeah.
Yeah. No, and that sounds a lot more fun.
I guess there were like 3 endings written and at least 2 of them were shot.
Yeah.
The baseball one, that's actually really funny, because with the Oliver Stone one, the reason that, like, the actual reason it didn't get made, because it was in full-on pre-production, but when it got canned, the studio changed executives, basically. And then the new executive read the script and was like, do you know what this movie needs? It needs a scene where our hero is kind of walking past a bunch of monkeys playing what seems to be baseball, but there's something missing. And our hero knows exactly what it is.
Oh, man.
And he became convinced that the key to this movie was the human teaching monkeys how to play baseball. And Oliver Stone was like, I already got paid for this. I'm not really going to, you know, I'm not even a big fan of these movies. So, you know, he just left.
Was this the Bull Durham Field of Dreams era? I have a feeling that it was like during that baseball in movies time.
I think it was. I think it was like early 90s. So I think you're exactly right.
God damn. This is why execs don't make movies.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
So bad.
Oh, shit. All right, let's take a break, and we will come right back after the trailer for the 2001 Tim Burton Planet of the Apes.
One day they'll tell a story, and some will say it was just a fairy tale about a human who came from the stars and changed our world.
Freedom is history.
Where am I? What is this place?
Get them out! And get them clean!
Brutality is law.
Rise on your master.
The powerful rule by fear.
Next you'll be telling us these beasts have a soul.
Is there a soul in there?
It's disgusting the way we treat humans.
How the hell did they get like this?
What other way would they be?
If they see you on the street, they kill you on sight.
You stay here, you are dead.
Which are you from?
United States Air Force. I'm going back. Bye.
Some humans have escaped.
Is there another way out of the city?
I can show you the way.
They travel with apes.
Declare martial law. We underestimate this human.
The hell are they?
The story is spreading through the villages. They all want to see this human who defies the apes.
Full of division! Full battle ready!
It's over. There's no help coming.
You came.
Sound the call to march!
Get me the spaceman.
This version of Planet of the Apes in 2001 was written by Lawrence Connor, who actually we talked about just a couple weeks ago. Sam, episode 234.
Oh, would that be Mighty Joe Young?
It might be. It might be, yes. As part of our apocalypse. Mark Rosenthal also had a hand in this script. Maybe it's showing somewhat because he wrote Superman IV, The Quest for Peace.
And he also was the contributor to Mighty Joe Young.
Yes, he was. Directed by Tim Burton, of course, who we've only talked about once before, but that was in episode 64.
That would be his remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Correct. Mark Wahlberg stars in this movie as Captain Leo Davidson, and I was actually surprised that they didn't stick with the original names in this movie, but maybe that's for the best. That's easily separated to different tribes and different events.
You know, I was reading somebody saying something about Mark Wahlberg saying he really is like one of the best actors who can play a blue collar American. So why do people keep casting him as a scientist?
Yes, please.
Like, answered. It's not a suited role for him at all.
Again, I got more of the feeling he was more of a pilot, and even though he was kind to the monkey during training, he was definitely had resentment that monkeys were replacing these pilots in these research missions. And it was mainly because they were lab animals, and they've deforested the planet. That's part of the story in this movie there's a lot of social stuff in this movie. Humans deforested the planet, so what's left of nature has been put into zoos and made lab animals in space stations and whatnot. But we've talked about Mark Wahlberg before, a few times before. First time was in episode 5.
I wasn't there for this one, but it was The Departed.
It was The Departed.
The Departed.
And then again in episode 91.
I was there for this one. That was the Italian Job.
And then again in episode 144.
That was Charade, The Truth About Charlie.
Yes.
Also a fun one. I really liked Charade.
Yeah, I really like Charade. Notice none of us are saying that about Truth About Charlie. Helena Bonham Carter was Ari. She was also in episode 64 of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and of course most famous for her current roles in the Harry Potter films, but she's pretty much in Tim Burton everything. Tim Roth, most famous for like roles like Pulp Fiction, and some of the younger guys will remember him from The Incredible Hulk. He played Thade, and woof, over-the-top villain.
Yeah. I loved him in this role, though. I thought he was good. I just loved him wrong.
Yeah, he's good. And he gives it all, but that villain was written way over the top. Like, there's no, like, out-and-out bad guy in the original film. You kind of see why Zaius is so resistant to believing in Taylor and trying to quiet them. And Thade, he's, for the most part, tries to keep secrets. He'll kill his own kind just to cover up, like, their discovery of the spaceship. He doesn't want that getting out either, but he mainly has political aspirations and he'll do anything to get there.
I think there was something sort of missing. There should have been something with Thade's backstory. Like, it's not so much about keeping humans down order sometimes. It's just he just freaking hates humans. Mm-hmm. And we didn't really get an answer on why.
I got the feeling he wasn't that fond of apes either.
No, because
Like, he's terrible. Humans, like, it's personal in the way.
When he's talking to Ari, I feel like trying to be the explanation. When he's talking to Ari, he's like, you care more about, like, I love these humans, but you don't care about me. Like, I think that's supposed to be, like, a partial explanation or somewhat, even though it's kind of awkward and doesn't really work.
You kind of get the feeling that there's supposed to be sort of this unrequited attraction to Ari, but it's kind of clumsy. Because it's really apparent at the end there where he puts his hand up, is like, he's trying to say, I did this all for you kind of thing. And it just doesn't quite work. Because he's so unlikable, you can't empathize with him in this moment.
And also, like, she's never shown in the movie anything but, like, fear and dislike for him. So I feel like if there was any connection between the two, that would have been a moment that could have been sold. But,
yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, as far as we knew, he was just a random stalker who just was obsessed with her, as far as we knew. Like, just who happened to be a general. Like, we have no idea.
All right. Also starring Michael Clark Duncan as Attar, and of course most famous for roles in The Green Mile, Armageddon, and Sin City. Paul Giamatti.
Daredevil.
I don't know if he's famous for Daredevil, but he was famous for playing the Kingpin even in animation. So I guess that did become a recurring role for him. Paul Giamatti was Limbo. He's always a constant favorite of mine. 12 Years a Slave, Man on the Moon, Private Parts.
Sideways.
Big Fat Liar.
Yeah. Shoot 'em up.
They're Sideways with the wine one.
Shoot 'em up was awesome. That's
Barney's version.
Estella Warren, best known for Driven, given Better or Worse. And it's much. Driven makes Planet of the Apes 2001 look like an Oscar winner. that is one shit-ass movie. Don't watch Driven.
Yeah.
One of the few Stallone-written things that was just complete trash. It's not well shot. I could go on the rest of this episode of why I don't like Driven. It is so bad. Kari Hiroyuki Tagawa is Krull. I love this actor. Most people remember him as, I don't remember his role, but as a villain in Mortal Kombat.
Mm-hmm.
But great Asian actor, and I think he had such a great kind of stern, understated role with this Krull character, this disgraced general that Thade had disagreements within the army, and of course, Thade came out on top of that one, and he winds up being taken in by Ari's family in service to them, and he's very loyal.
And in my notes, I actually wrote down, I'm like, I love Krull. He's awesome.
Yep. Yeah, he was my favorite character in the movie next to Paul. Well, you're not supposed to like Paul Giamatti. He is a slaver, after all. But he did play it well.
So infectious.
Yeah, he is. I also love David Warner. He's not in it very much, but he plays Ari's father, Senator Sandor. We've talked about him before. I mean, he's most famous for being in Tron and Star Trek 5 and 6, but we talked about him in episode 159.
I missed it. I'm sorry.
Oh, that was The Omen.
What's funny? It's, I just watched Cursed, and I actually watched the scene where he died, and I never made the freaking connection.
Oh, man. Cursed is good.
Chris Christopherson's in here, and I'm actually surprised at what a small part he played in this. Most people remember him from Blade, but he's a spectacular actor who got no fucking screen time really in this movie.
So he's also like an incredibly prolific musician. He's a huge actor to just be a cardboard character played by anyone who has 5 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
I was reading, and he just really wanted to work with Tim Burton.
Oh, fair.
Wild.
We have actually talked about Chris Christopherson before, and that was in episode 38.
That would be Point Blank and Payback. Payback in particular.
Eric Avari was Tivol, and we talked about in episode 61.
Oh, I missed that one.
That would have been the Mummy.
Yes. That's where I remember him from. He was so
Darn it, yeah.
Now it's clicking.
Yeah.
Lucas Elliot Eberl was Burn. He was in Letters from Iwo Jima, a nice big movie. Evan Park was Gunner in a different ape movie. That would have been episode 78.
King Kong, I didn't miss that one.
Yeah. Lisa Marie was Nova, best known for other Tim Burton movies, Ed Wood, Mars Attacks. If you saw some a big busted, tiny, wasted woman, that would have been her.
Yeah. And I wonder if naming her Nova was a nod to Kim Novak's character, even though she was kind of really a secondary character in the remake.
Nova was the non-speaking human.
Mm-hmm.
No, but yeah, I think that, when there's two movies and then there's the same name, there's got to be not a coincidence.
Yeah, Nova would have been Linda Harrison's character, but it was clearly just a nod, and I honestly don't even remember Nova's name coming up. This movie is also instantly forgettable most of the time. There are some notable cameos, though. If you're really looking through the makeup sometimes, you can catch them. Deep Roy was a Gorilla Kid, but not a surprise. Okay, yeah. Tim Burton's worked with him many times. Kevin Grievous, who's best known for writing and directing some of the Underworld movies and also playing one of the big Lycans. He was actually Limbo's, one of his handler gorillas in this movie. Rick Baker plays an old ape in this movie.
Yep.
Linda Harrison, the original Nova, played Woman in Cart. And of course, Charlton Heston had a scene dying on a bed as Zaius. They don't call him Dr. Zaius, they just call him Zaius. And there's lots of other cameos, I'm sure you'll spot. These are the ones that I thought were most notable to mention. So.
Yeah, especially like the cameos by original cast members, right?
Yeah.
I'm surprised that that Kim Hunter wasn't in it, because she, yeah, as we mentioned, she still acts.
Yeah.
I thought she did have a small part.
She might have. I might have missed it. I could have missed it, or she just didn't want to do it. I don't know.
There was one you didn't say, and it's, I don't know if it's like a cameo, but it's Glenn Shaddix, who has worked with Tim Burton like a lot. He was Otho in Beetlejuice, and he was that senator who came in with Lisa Marie.
Oh, yes, yes. With a really deep voice.
Yes. And yeah. I was looking at him going, like, he's so familiar. And that's how I actually stumbled upon that one. I'm like, oh, of course Glenn Shaddix is in this, because he's pretty good.
Yeah.
And Burton loves him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. He's got such that recognizable voice, and Nightmare Before Christmas. Yeah, they work together a lot. He was one of the more unique looking gorillas. He looks like Maurice from the Rise of the Planet of the Apes, so that type of ape. But I did like from the original film where there seemed to be a hierarchy. They only had three types of apes, and you could kind of tell them apart, you know? Like the chimpanzees were the scientists, the orangutans were the theologians and politicians, and then the gorillas were the army. And for the most part, that still holds true here. There's a little bit more variety, but Thade being a general who is a chimpanzee, not a gorilla, so that in and of itself was a bit unusual. But I guess with his political aspirations, he was kind of coming through, trying to unite these two factions, I'm guessing.
Yeah, again, maybe something that was missing from the story as to why a chimpanzee was a general in the army. They just kind of followed the theme except for that sort of one anomaly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
And then, of course, Limbo was also a slave trader versus being a theologian or an administrator. Mm-hmm. Right? And, oh man, that makeup was amazing. I mean, he looked like an orangutan.
He did. Yeah. He looked really good. Impressive.
I don't know what it is about orangutans, but for whatever reason, in movies, when people try to make when they fake an orangutan with special effects, I don't know why the orangutans always are more successful than other monkeys, to me anyway. Like in the mocap and the Planet of the Apes other remakes, and Paul Giamatti in this one, just like something about orangutans that you can really get across in makeup or special effects. I don't know what it is.
They're like us.
Yeah, it could honestly just be
so I'm
that.
I'm all team orangutan.
Yeah, maybe they have similar eyes to people, and it's just the eyes.
But the only thing I was kind of disappointed too is Ari is not a scientist in this one. She's just an activist.
Yeah, she's a human activist instead of an animal.
She's that PETA, Greenpeace, 90s activist.
Yeah.
Or 2000s activist with a friend's haircut.
Yeah, this is where, like, I kind of, like, when I said this is kind of the SJW version of Planet of the Apes, where, you know, they talk about the humans having destroyed the planet even before the time travel aspect, and the animals being used for research in zoos. That's the only place they exist. And then you have the animal activism in here as well as a fairly big theme, where Ares trying to free the slave humans and help them escape as well.
Yeah, it kind of feels like they took the themes from the original and went, okay, just so you don't miss them, we're going to make sure that we hit you over the head with them.
It does, yeah. It feels really heavy-handed.
You know, knowing that Mark Rosenthal had a hand in this and Mighty Joe Young, I feel like all of the ways in which he updated Mighty Joe Young, or at least what I would imagine his contributions, kind of also come into effect with this movie, except not as successfully. Because he does kind of do the same thing where, as we talked about in the other podcast, but... like, he kind of creates a villain who's kind of really over the top, and, like, you can't really make an argument for them at all. It's just, and other stuff, like, how can we update this for 2001, you know?
Yeah, well, it becomes more typical formula of having a clear villain, right? Instead of being the science fiction story, the more thinking piece, really, the original actually is, as you piece it together. I mean, Taylor is not a shining example of a good human. And neither is Mark Wahlberg, for the most part. I mean, he's running around calling these apes monkeys, which gets him in Dutch a couple of times, especially with Krull, who teaches him a little respect.
Doesn't even say, like, later, even after everybody's been chastising him, he's like, come on, let's go teach these monkeys some evolution.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, let's do a badass line like he's not learned a damn thing.
Yeah. Well,
and that's one of the biggest things that they miss an opportunity on in this remake, too, is this is all his fault. Every single thing is his fault.
Yeah.
When he goes chasing off after Pericles, he sets everything in motion, and he never acknowledges this at all when he realizes, no, this is my fault. I did this.
No, he does. He does acknowledge it. He doesn't feel too bad too long about it. No. You know, he sees the tapes and realizes it's his fault.
Until he goes back to Earth and realizes that he's also fucked up somewhere else as well. Like, he's a big fuck up.
it's funny when he says the monkey can land better than he can. It's true. He crashes every time. Mark Wahlberg is that character in DuckTales, Launchpad. Just, I'll crash everything. Like, this is why the monkey's got to go out first.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
What? No.
Well, there's a whole thing when you talk about the original. It is more of a thinking movie, because there's a whole point where there's a hearing. Like, it's not... there's some action moments, but it's more about the story. And then I think this one, they're like, oh, we just need to make Planet of the Apes as a blow 'em up action flick. And that's where it kind of all, that was to me the beginning point where it all goes wrong.
Well, you know, Planet of the Apes, I feel like this Planet of the Apes is the first modern remake, at least in my mind. Like, a lot of, it has a lot of the hallmarks of how you remake a lot of movies, but I think it's also maybe the early cautionary tale that people ignored, but.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we'll remake it, but we'll make more things explode. That seems to be the way they do it.
I guess that just thinking about what we're saying about Mark Wahlberg just causing everything, you know, if Thade wasn't such a two-dimensional, obviously evil villain, the movie would have had more time to, breathe with, the stuff with Mark Wahlberg's character, which I actually think is more interesting, the fact that he is the cause of everything.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not really allowed to think that.
Yeah, if they would have concentrated a little bit more on the political structure and cover-up that's going on, we would have probably had a much more interesting movie, because Tim Burton one just kind of dumbs down what the original is and is heavy-handed and very quick on trying to get some of those messages out. Very quick on the fan service. They're very much all those big lines that you would expect are there. Some big moments. Even the crash space station resembles the Statue of Liberty in the sand.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the big complaints I did read a few sort of reviews of the remake, and the big complaint is that the characters never really develop or grow. I mean, it's really apparent in Wahlberg's character where, he realizes it's his fault, but he doesn't sort of acknowledge the repercussions of it or deal with the repercussions of it or how it makes him feel. He's like, yeah, okay, I've got other things to deal with, and never really goes back to it.
But can I deal with, the biggest problem of the fact that it's all his fucking fault? At the end, Ari's like, well, there'll be tales of a man who dropped from the sky and he changed everything. I'm like, no, He caused everything. And if you didn't get him out of that little jail, he wouldn't have done fuck all. Like,
there's that too.
Yeah. He becomes a savior at the end when he was the worst one.
I mean, he did change everything for the ape society because he proved their religious grounds and the things that they believed were false. So
yeah, but her contribution to it is ignored.
Yeah, in that regard she was right. But
it is more of a case like he's a character in this movie who, like, he could be any character. Like, his decisions that he makes are not necessarily like driven by anything other than that's just what he needs to do to move the story forward.
Yeah. It feels like basic survival, and even then he's not nearly as stripped down as Taylor was. I mean, Taylor lost all his resources at the beginning when he finally gets there. Once the clothes are stolen and the equipment are stolen, he's left with nothing to survive. And he's got his ship and he has a gun for about 10 seconds until Krell destroys it. Yeah. So there's the whole anti-gun message, which is kind of ironic.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's not really. There's the anti-gun message. Then at the end, Thane gets a gun from his dad, Charles Heston. And that becomes a whole thing again. So it's, I don't know, it's gun, it's anti-gun. It's all over the place with that.
Yeah, that's true.
And then he goes back to Earth and there's a ton of guns there. It's a whole thing.
Yeah, I think he only told the apes to do is arm themselves.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about the other elephant in the room?
There were elephants in the room?
Figurative. Elephant in the room.
Oh, there's no cows on this planet. That was my problem.
There's that too. But when they arrive at the ship there, and after he sort of discovers that it's his ship and stuff, he comes out, and all of a sudden, all these humans start showing up.
Out of nowhere. How did they even hear? Yeah. Like, I know the rumor mill works fast, but it ain't work that fast if there's no technology.
Like they needed to be broken out of jail. Like, who broke out all those other people?
Yeah. Well, I would have thought some of these would have been other villages and whatnot, other settlements of humans.
They do say that, and they say that they've heard about you, and they think that you're the ones that's going to save the humans. But how did they hear about him?
Yeah, exactly. The humans that escaped with them, and the ones that weren't with them pretty much got killed early on. Who sent the message?
They know there's other villages, but we don't know how they got the idea that. Yeah.
Yeah, they just show up out of nowhere.
Just like the humans on that planet.
Yes.
Yeah, like it's so unlike Burton, just sort of throw something into a script just for an action scene. Everything he usually does makes sense. Like, it ties into the rest of the story.
I don't know if it's so unlike modern Burton. This might have been, you've seen Alice in Wonderland, right?
No, yeah, I haven't, because I've been really disappointed in his remake. So
yeah, well, it's not a remake, but it's more of a sequel.
But regardless, I've been disappointed in everything he's done based on somebody else's material.
Yeah. And I kind of feel like with this one, I got the sense that, like, usually with Tim Burton movies, if he's not also writing it, he at the very least is very involved with the script on a script level. And I kind of feel like, out of all the movies I've seen, even some of his newer ones, which are not as good, I feel like the disconnect between him and the script is probably the biggest in this one out of all of his movies.
That's a really good observation, actually.
Yeah. Now, Burton, Sam nailed it on the head. Burton's best when he's working on original properties rather than concepts, because it popped in my head at how bad Dark Shadows was as well.
And even Miss Peregrine's was, like, not great.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember that one. I think I liked it.
I haven't seen it. But Sleeping Hollow, although not original, he kind of tapped into it. I loved Sleepy Hollow. I thought that was really good.
Yeah.
I would say that's the best work he's done based on somebody else's material, for sure.
Absolutely.
But it's also one of the stories that lends itself really well to the way Tim Burton tells stories.
Yes.
Right. And Dark Shadows should have been that.
Yeah, because he's really good with dark and gothic.
Yeah.
But yeah, that one, just something didn't click there.
Yeah, maybe too much source material on that one.
Maybe. Okay, anything else you guys want to talk about here? I mean, there's still quite a bit of things we can compare.
Oh, there are a lot.
Well, I have to say, like, going back to the whole Mark Wahlberg saved us all crap, it's a trope in movies that bothers me the most, is like, this guy saved us, but it's the guy who caused the entire problem. It's the same problem I've had with Iron Man in several movies. It's the reason you're in a fucking mess, but you're thankful that he got you out of the fucking mess that he created. no, you should be mad at this person, like, constantly.
Yeah. Well, at least he was adult enough to clean up his mess. But Mark Wahlberg doesn't clean up his mess.
Better. Yeah. Yes. No, he doesn't.
As a matter of fact, he stirs the pot, then leaves.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's like, okay, well, I've saved the humans, and I've dissembled all of your religion. I'm going to fuck off now.
Right?
It just leaves them at the most precarious spot in their history and just fucks off.
Oh, actually, there is something I wanted to mention. Is one thing that I think they did really well is establish that Thade is from, oh, I can't remember the name of sort of the leader of the apes when they first land, who sort of organized.
Yeah, that was actually good because they had aligned his genetic line to the ape from the crash of the space station that started rebelling against the humans. First, they were helping each other survive, and the apes were a lot smarter than they gave them credit for. And then this one ape, who, yeah, I can't remember his name either. I'm sure I wrote it down somewhere in my notes here.
Demon is what they called him.
Something like that.
You know, when they first said it, I thought they said Caesar, and I was like, man, big missed opportunity there. But anyway.
But, yeah, so this ape that leads the revolt with the other apes, which spawns this society, and Thade and his father Zaius are a direct descendants of it, of this ape, and his very loyal soldier Atar, who winds up killing Krull, realizes, because he's very religious, Atar, and once he realizes everything he believes in deeply is a lie, and this traitor was part of this line that he loyally followed, he was just gutted. He's like, no, we do belong in coexistence with the humans.
Yeah.
It does make you wonder what happened after Wahlberg left, because he was telling the rest of, he's like, no, this is what we know is wrong. We should be. This has all been, you know, the rival, this guy for the upheaval our society has been prophesized. Yeah. You would have thought that Leo Davidson, Mark Wahlberg's character, would have become the god among them at that point after arriving, fucking everything up, and then leaving again.
Yeah. Yeah.
In technology, they don't even understand.
Yeah. And
you know, I almost feel like it would have been nice, like, instead of setting up a sequel after he leaves, like, you know, any sort of epilogue at all with, like, anything that happens with the people after he leaves would have been a much needed closure to the story.
Well, they were aiming for a sequel. That's the whole thing. Like, this is a ham-fisted, we're going to make another one.
Speaking of sequels, this was a statistic I read, which I thought was crazy, because I was kind of mentioning earlier, if this movie was made today, like, it would get a sequel, but with it's crazier that it didn't get a sequel, because out of the 14 movies that were pretty big that came out in 2001, I think 12 of them got sequels, and Planet of the Apes was one of the ones that didn't. And in some of the ones that did get sequels are ones where you're like, I can't believe that got a sequel. So,
well, $362 million on a $100 million budget, and with the heavy marketing that had, I can see why that just wasn't profitable enough. The original movie went on from its $5.8 million to do $32.5 million, so pretty good. And it was one of the first, if not the first, movie to have a lot of toy and merchandising tie-ins, which is, you know, for 1968, that's pretty early.
I mean, people usually credit George Lucas with the merchandising and stuff over Star Wars, and that's you know, it's like almost 10 years before that.
Yeah, no, this kind of sets that market up and saying, hey, yeah, we are marketing this to children. I mean, you think about it, Planet of the Apes, it was a G movie and had male nudity in it.
And talked about gelding him.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, there's some disturbing stuff. Like, there's during the hunt.
He discovers his
during the hunt or after the hunt, and you've got some of these hunters taking pictures over a pile of human bodies.
Yes.
Like,
there's human bodies hung upside down.
Like fish.
Yeah.
Like, it's really disturbing. And like, some of that is,
it reminded me of Cannibal Holocaust, which is wild.
And some of that is intact in Burton's as well. But I find that scene, the version of the original, far more disturbing than what Burton did.
But that scene, when I watch it, is like going, oh yeah, no, that's big game hunting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is perfectly in line with what happens.
Yeah, well, you know, it does make sense, but it's more disturbing because you're seeing yourself among the bodies, right? It's like, wow, this is really heavy stuff to be throwing at kids. as a G audience. You know what? It's still a hit.
For the original movie, I think that partly why the original movie works so much better than the Tim Burton remake is there's so much in the original movie that is kind of like nonverbal communication of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like when you see all of those bodies like hanging and they're just like moving the dead bodies into a pile and all this other stuff, like that is all shorthand for like, these are not people, they're animals.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's how they're viewed. There's a lot of subtlety in the original one and there's not any subtlety.
It is like, here's your slaver gorilla. It is really in your face as far as what it's going for, and they almost have to spell it out for you and make it clear as day, and it does make you feel like, man, this is being spoon-fed to me and I feel stupider just watching this.
Well, and there's two things I wanted to mention. One is you brought up Attar, and I love Michael Clarke Duncan, rest in peace, but he had the worst dialogue in the movie too. His lines all felt really awkward.
Well, I mean, God rest his soul, but Michael Clarke Duncan was never best at delivering dialogue to begin with.
Fair enough.
He had one really great role where it all kind of came together in The Green Mile, but that was by far, I think, his best performance in my mind. And I never thought he was that good in anything after that.
No, that's fair. I think and having him hidden behind that makeup kind of really allowed to show the stilted way he delivers lines, because you couldn't see his facial expressions, because that's where he was good, was in his facial expression.
You couldn't hide, like, a part of what made his role, like, he's supposed to be Thate's heavy, and he never comes off to me really threatening, because Michael Clarke Duncan, even under all that makeup, has really kind eyes. Did you notice that? Like, I thought, like, here's this really kind-looking ape.
Yeah, there is some of that. You're right.
So I didn't really buy him as a bad guy.
Except at the supper that they're having with the senators, where he kind of goes a little bit like, you guys settle down.
No, where he says you have to pray and stuff like that. That was by far his strongest scene for me.
I'd agree with that, yeah.
You know, that actually, it might even be one of the stronger scenes of just actors interacting with each other in the movie. Like, that whole dinner sequence was not too bad at all. I mean, honestly, most of the ape actors are really good in the remake. And, just the humans, nothing there.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've shoehorned a whole bunch of human actors in there that did nothing. The servant characters who were sort of along for the ride, but they served no purpose to the story.
Right? A lot of the casting was like, here's some recognizable faces you'll know. Because Chris Christopherson, that dude from The Mummy, Eric Avari, like, they're just pointless background characters, but you recognize them from other things you like, so you kind of like them. Yeah. But they just feel like space fills, and it's like, well, you could have got a different actor for that small part and probably shaved off a good hunk of your budget in doing so.
Yeah, and that was the other point I was going to make, was just the fact that there were these extraneous human characters in there, and it felt like, well, somebody had said, you need more humans in there for our audience to connect to. But that's not what the movie's about, right? And that's not what the original was about, and that's where it really fails. The audience is making it about the humans instead of it being about the story.
Well, the problem the problem is you don't connect to the humans, and you don't connect to the apes either. I mean, the one bad guy you feel is really bad, but even the good guy apes are kind of pathetic.
You know, we were talking even earlier about how the most likable ape in the movie is a slave trader.
Yeah.
So
it tells you a lot is wrong with this one. And he's really the only one that learns a lesson. Well, and his lesson was, I'm like, now I have double the amount of people to trade with.
Yeah.
That was his lesson. More corporate change.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, bigger market.
Yeah.
I liked Krull and Ari, though. They were good.
Yeah, I really liked Krull. I did not like Ari. Like, I thought initially I kind of did, but then through the travels to get to the space station, she's so whiny and just useless through most of that.
Definitely doesn't have the depth that Zira had in the original. Like, Zira, she was intelligent and she had motivation for everything she was doing, whereas Ari kind of feels throwaway. Mm-hmm. She's just there to move the story forward, just like so much of this movie.
This is why I wanted her to be a scientist, because in the original, it's like Azira and Cornelius, they're talking about like a theory that apes were descended from humans. Like, there's this whole bit, and that's like the point of bringing down the current system, is that their theory is kind of correct in a way for that particular...
You know, in the original movie, too, like, you know, you're exactly right. There's like there's also this like a small, like almost kind of secondary story going on, which is there's these ape scientists which are challenging the ape religion.
Yes.
You know, like that is also very interesting. Like we as the audience know their ape religion is wrong, and we know that the scientists they're not exactly right, but having that inter-ape conflict in terms of their society, rather than just people, they believe in, you know, God or they don't, like in the remake. Yeah. It's not as interesting.
Didn't one of the, like, scientist apes in the remake, during that dinner scene, mention to Wahlberg that he might be a missing link, and then he gets all upset that I'm no missing link, or whatever.
Yeah.
I think that was a throwaway nod to that.
I like so much of the movie, there are a lot of throwaway nods.
Yeah, it's like, okay, well, we recognize this is a good idea, let's throw it in the script, never to revisit it.
It's almost like they had a checklist of things that they had to be sure that they addressed, but once they were addressed, they'd fulfilled their obligation and, you know, didn't explore it further.
Exactly.
Actually, a lot of the movie does feel very checklisty, actually.
Yeah, when you say it out loud like that, it absolutely does feel like a lot of boxes are being checked, but there's no real logical cohesion to it. It just, we want to make an action movie. We've checked the boxes for the fan service, and there's no real depth or function to it. And ultimately, the whole movie is counterproductive, as we've discussed. IMDb gives this, the original movie, a really high rating of 8.0 out of 10.
Wow.
Really high rating. IMDb gives the remake a 5.7 out of 10. Which is probably fairly forgiving. Rotten Tomatoes gives, critic score was 88%. What do you think the audience score is?
For the remake or the original? Or
the original.
93.
Okay, 93. Yeah,
probably pretty high.
68.
Okay.
I would say probably in like Sam's ballpark. I'd say it would probably be in the 90s.
Okay, well, like I said, the critic said 88% and the audience pretty much agreed at 87%. Okay. So were pretty much dead even.
That never happens.
Critics weren't so kind to the remake, though. The critics gave a 44% to the film. Any guesses on what the audience's perception of the film was?
Ooh, higher or lower? I feel like a Price is Right game is happening here.
It is,
I'm going to go with 38%.
Okay.
You said a 44?
44 was critic one.
I'm gonna say, I don't know, like 52%.
All right.
That was my guess, was 52. Can I do 52 too?
Yeah, sure, you could do 52 also.
Okay, thank you.
But Sam was closest, and he still overshot at a whopping 27% audience score.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, audiences really did not like this movie.
I just thought since it was successful that, you know, it's usually what happens is when the critics dump on it and it still makes a decent amount of money. Usually it's the audience that's a little higher. I was betting on that.
Well, I think a lot of the audience was like Jay and me, where it's like, okay, cool, Tim Burton, Planet of the Apes, gotta see it. So you go.
When you've got fans of Tim Burton who are us, you've got fans of the original Planet of the Apes who are us, it seems like it's going to be great. And those trailers were pretty awesome at the time when you're not having context, and it looked pretty cool, which is why it had a nice big opening. But unfortunately, it doesn't deliver. I mean, this movie, if it had been more cohesive and had a more thinking aspect to it, like these prequel movies have introduced, it would have gone on to been a $500 million movie or more.
Yeah.
Well, cause it was the highest opening. I think not the highest. I think it was the third highest opening weekend ever for a movie when it came out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was big.
It had a huge built-in audience.
Yeah. Just didn't get the revisits to the theater.
And I'll be honest, until this weekend, I had not seen it since I saw it in the theater with you, Jay.
I'm trying to think. I may not have either, to be honest.
You know what? Honestly, the last time I watched it, I think also was when it came out.
And I know we didn't. I know me and Sam didn't contribute to the dollar take because it was a screener for us.
Yeah. Yep.
I think my friend Mike was with me as well. Oh no, I remember he was at Rise with us.
Yeah.
And he was like, even before the movie started, if the monkeys talk, I'm fucking out of here. And I'm like, have you seen a Planet of the Apes movie?
Yeah.
I'm like, you might as well go home now.
Right?
It's going to happen.
That's the whole point.
I think I'm in the same boat as everybody else, as I went to the movie in the theaters, and this is the first time I've seen it since then.
So it never.
There's a reason for that too.
Yeah, it obviously didn't sit well with any of us. And if you're just looking at it from a makeup standpoint, oh, incredible. Does it look good? Like, the sets look good and it's well lit and there's some great actors under some great makeup. It looks amazing. It's just not particularly good.
And that's something I wanted to mention too, is the body movement was so good, right? They kept certain aspects of each ape and made sure they sort of integrated that into the characters, even though they were evolved, they still had some of these primitive movements. And I loved that part of it.
I loved some of those qualities that were in the performances. And this is before mocap. This is all in-camera makeup. This is looks really good. If you could have just remade that original movie as is with that makeup, fuck, I would have been so happy. Those makeup and that set, those sets, I would have been probably really happy. I would have been maybe a little upset that they didn't try something new, but at the same time, it would have looked really good. And at least it's a story we like.
I had one thing about the original that bothered me a bit. There's a few things that did. But when there's a whole bit where Charlton Heston can't speak because he's gotten shot in the throat, there are several things I kept thinking. One, he should have died. Two, he can't speak for a large portion of the movie. And then there's that whole chase scene where he goes through the town and, like, they get him around the neck several times. He gets more trauma to his neck and then he can speak.
That's a good point.
I mean, it's like,
you
know,
you get kicked by a donkey and your eyes cross and you fall down a well and they uncross.
Yes, that's what I thought it was. It was like that whole amnesia. He's got amnesia. We better hit him again.
Considering what an asshole his character was, I was actually disappointed when he was allowed to talk again.
Oh, true.
That's also another aspect of the movie I actually really love is, like, nobody can talk, and then he sustains a trauma at the beginning of the movie that makes him, even though he is intelligent and can speak, he's the same to all of the other apes, and that dynamic was also really, really effective.
Only Zira's kind of recognizing, that's where the bright eyes line comes from, which Rise uses later, is she sees something and sees that he's trying to communicate. And I loved when he's trying to write in the sand and Zaius kicks it over. The scruffle with some of the other humans messes most of it up, but the few letters that remain, Zaius covers it up. He's like, that was probably your first notice of, like, oh, Zaius knew this whole time who this what this was about and who this was, and he's trying to cover this up.
Yeah, and actually, and I wanted to mention one of my favorite scenes in the original is the scene where he introduces them to flight.
Yes.
The paper airplane. I love that.
I love that. It's one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie.
Again, and Zaius picks it up and crushes it, doesn't even throw it, just he's like, I'm aware of this. He's not going to say anything. No. He's like, no, this will disrupt our society if I say this. Yeah. Good
and
stuff.
I love the bit where was it keeper of the faith, but yet like a lead scientist. And he's sitting there defending. He's like, oh, no, I find there's no conflict here. I mean, because he's the keeper of the faith, which means he can't allow anything through that might dissuade like the whole belief system. But he's like the lead scientist who's supposed to like investigate stuff. So it's quite funny where he's like saying, oh, no, I see no conflict. But it was very indicative, I think, of the time.
Yeah. And Taylor is the one that challenges of the separation of faith and politics and science. And that was interesting. And you think about early society and that makes perfect amount of sense. Absolutely. As well. Yeah, it was good. I'm very much hoping that these new films that have done the prequels with Caesar and stuff will start moving into the more evolved Planet of the Apes now that we've seen the downfall of society. I certainly liked how the viral aspect of those prequels explains how humanity has dwindled out and the survivors, their exposure to it renders them mute and affects their intelligence as well. So they've done a good job of setting up, and even if they never remake it, it meshes fairly well with those new movies.
Yeah, you could watch them in order and it would still make
sense. Because there's a lot of stuff that's left to conjecture in these original films. It's like, well, what happened to society? Based on Taylor's reaction, he's assumed something cataclysmic has happened of nuclear nature or whatever, but we don't really know. And now that we have these prequel films with some of that explanation, it works really well. And even if they never do it, those prequels mesh pretty good with those 60s and 70s films.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I can say that the original movie is actually a really good allegory for what's happening right now, as always. Yeah. With that, especially with the sort of separation of church and state and church and science and just the cultural separation that we still see.
Mm-hmm. Oh, And I wrote down, too, when you talk about, like, all the orangutans are kind of the ones in politics and in charge and making all the policies. I'm like, yeah, there is a very homogeneous looking group of people who are just making all the decisions for everybody who isn't an orangutan.
Yeah, dumb orange people. I don't know what that means.
Oh, I thought you meant me because I was like, I
no, have- no, no, no,
no. Now I get it. Now that I've had a moment, but yeah, dumb orange people. Wow, it's wow. Did Planet of the Apes know the future? The future? Holy shit!
Did they have a Simpsons moment?
Yeah. Holy shit, guys! What just happened?
And I think we're going to leave Prime April with that. Because wow. What a great place to leave it with dumb orange people. Stop putting orangutans in the office.
Yeah. That's the lesson from Prime April.
Yeah, Prime April. See,
now you got me thinking about his facial expressions even.
Mm.
Oh, my God.
Oh,
and making all the wrong decisions. Yes, he very much is an orangutan in Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, it's just bureaucracy.
Yeah, for sure. All right, well, that was Prime April Apocalypse. Thanks for Jeff for bringing this up. It was great fun for us. And if you want to see it return, let us know in the comments on our social media at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and Invasion the Remake at gmail.com. You can also send us your suggestions, your corrections, your comments over to that email address. And we have a fan challenge coming up next week, so join us there. That did come through email, so we hear you. And if we like your idea, it might become a future episode. So get your voices heard and communicate with us on any of those places, and we'll talk right back to you. It's us. We don't have a little helper monkey doing our emails and replies on Twitter. It is us apes that are far less evolved.
Far less. Trust me. I know who does the Twitter, and I know that person is definitely not evolved.
And make sure you tell your friends and family about the show. We're, of course, in a ton of different places, and we're now on Spotify, so there's even more options to find us. So just tell them to find Invasion of the Remake. Search us out on all your favorite podcast platforms. You can find our link tree on our social media, and we also have a new website as a central hub as well. Sam, give them that web address.
It is invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast.
So you can find it there, and of course all our episodes are over at Libsyn as well. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, lots of places. There's no excuses. You can find us everywhere, even on frickin' YouTube. So find us in all those places, and we will continue giving you episodes each and every week, even under these isolation conditions. And hopefully we'll be able to convene back in studio sooner rather than later. But stay healthy and be supportive of each other, and we're happy to entertain you during this weird era in our history.
Very weird.
Yeah, you've been isolated for like a lot longer than the rest of us, so.
I know, and just, I don't know if any of our listeners are going through this, because like my time clock is real messed up. Like, I cannot get up. Like, I'm up all night. And then, yeah, just wondering if anybody can determine the difference between something that's really bad and just normal day crying.
What is normal day crying?
It just happens.
It's what you do when you normal day drinking.
Yeah, I guess.
Okay, well,
not always when I day drink.
None of those things are normal to me.
Oh, no. Okay.
All right. Well, I've been Jason.
I am always Sam.
I continue to be Trish.
And I always come back as Jeff Omega.
And we are out of here.
Oh my God, I'm back. I'm home. All the time. We finally, really did it. You maniacs! You blew it up! Oh, damn you! God!